In the first session, I described how resistant my skeptical mind was to integrate my experience of seeing my son be cured from a pretty intense acute illness with homeopathy. It's said that seeing is believing, but in truth the opposite is true. It is only when you believe, or at least when you're open to the possibility of experiencing, that you can see. And the paradigm that has shaped our cognitive model of the way the world works is what allows us not only to interpret, but what allows us to perceive what is happening. In the first session, I also described how two opposing philosophical foundations for medicine, going back at least as far as ancient Greece, related to each other. One, exemplified by Galen, was the materialist or rationalist perspective, which in modern terms gave rise to diagnostic and disease categories, and mechanical explanations of how disease comes about. And the other tradition guiding the development and evolution of medicine was the vitalist tradition, which was pointed at by Hippocrates. And the vitalist tradition, as we reviewed, holds that disease is a condition of the unique and whole human being and should be understood as part of the particularity of the essence of that human being. And then I explained how Hahnemann's system of homeopathy represents the culmination of that vitalist tradition. So he developed the system of medicine where rather than give a material quantity of a medicinal substance to oppose a disease or to correct a biochemical imbalance, he used the energetic, dynamic, and informational essence of a substance to guide an organism into balance and into wholeness. So then in the second session, we reviewed the use of several remedies in emergency and first aid situations. Now, as I said, the vast majority of illness is chronic, and healing requires a remedy carefully chosen to match the unique subjective experience and the symptoms of the patient. However, when there's a sudden, overwhelming external stress, a sudden external influence, such as trauma, fire, natural disaster or something like that, an accident, certain remedies can be relied upon without such an in-depth examination. So one example that I gave was aconitum, which I found paradoxically useful in a mountain village in Haiti for two seemingly very different things. In this mountain village, many of the children were getting high fevers and respiratory infections. Many of these children were cured with aconitum. Many of their parents suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder from the earthquake of January 2010, with a lot of PTSD kinds of symptoms, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, inability to sleep in their houses at night. This was also cured by the same remedy, aconitum. So how could that be? How do we understand this paradox? It's a sign of the unitary nature of who we are, that our mind and our body are two expressions of the same being, that they can't really be completely separated. So in the third session on, Wednesday, we saw the transformation of a 13-year-old boy from a deeply fearful and anxious child who was overwhelmed both by the demands of school and whose immune system was overwhelmed continuously by every passing germ. And we saw him evolve with the help of the remedy man Sanella to a happy, healthy child with no unusual troubles. Just seeing him from beginning of treatment to end of treatment, we could see that it was truly transformational. And I also shared a case of a 42-year-old adult male who was cured not only of a life-threatening blood disorder, ITP, but of a tendency and a need to use his personality as a way of trapping and manipulating people, with a homeopathic remedy made from the chameleon. So a real chameleon changes its colors as a way to survive in the animal realm of predatory-prey relationships. And our patient's skin changed colors as part of his disease process. But which is a deeper explanation of his idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura? Is it a biochemical explanation of what caused his bone marrow to stop producing enough platelets? Or is it understanding more how he experienced his own life in his own world? Welcome.
Welcome. Oh, yeah, hi.
So that brings us to tonight's topic. What are we? What does this say about who and what we are? One thing that homeopathy has taught me, coming from a conventional medical training as a nurse practitioner into my experience with homeopathy, is that unlike the implication of my medical training, is that we are not really organic machines that are just subject to breakdown over time or randomly made sick by passing germs. We are not a self split down the middle, one part physical, soma, and the other part mental, psyche. We are rather primarily form. Now, Rupert Sheldrake is an English biologist. I believe he was born in 1948. And he's still alive, and he's written a number of very interesting books, including A New Biology of Life. And he postulates the existence of morphogenic fields, which he says are non-local fields of information which guide the development of species. They're non-localized fields of information which guide the entelechy of every substance that is in resonance with it. Entelechy is a word that comes to us from Aristotle, and it refers to the unique potential of everything to become truly what it is, given the right circumstances. Another thinker who I greatly admire is David Bohm, who is a theoretical physicist. He was born, I believe, in 1917, an American, and died, I think his dates were 1992. And a theoretical physicist, his books are not that easy to digest, but certain chapters, reading them, it's almost like reading sacred text. In one chapter, he postulates an exercise for us, the readers. He says, try to write something or read something, eliminating all nouns and substituting only verbs. Because he says, if I understand him correctly, that verbs are closer to the true nature of reality than nouns. Because verbs have within them the experience of movement, the experience of flow, and that the underlying basis for reality has much more to do with a unitary, undivided wholeness which is in constant flux and constant movement. So I know this is a very busy slide, and I myself don't understand everything in it. But I put it up there just to give you the sense of his thinking, which is at the ground of reality, and this is not a theologian, this is a theoretical physicist speaking. He's saying there is an absolute unity. He calls it holo movement. And that what we see, and that within this absolute unity, within this holo movement, there is an implicate order. And that what we experience as explicate order has gone through this process of holistic simplification, where realities from this underlying experience of movement emerge into our explicate daily lives.
What was his name again?
David Bohm, B-O-H-M. So for me, form is prior to and deeper than matter. Implicate order, the deep flow that underlies all reality, unfolds first, not into particles, but rather into forms. One example of that that I can think of is, you know, when you recognize an old friend, say you haven't seen him or her in 20 years, you know, biologists will tell us that he or she will not likely have a single molecule or particle that was present at your last encounter. But still, she's unmistakably your friend, right? The form is more, is deeper, more essential to who he or she is than any particular molecule or cell or tissue. And I want to take the liberty of referring to Suze Mattins this morning, because it really touched me, as well as many of you, I'm sure, when she described Holden Village as an organism. And as she said, the essence of Holden Village, I will paraphrase, cannot be described or contained by any one individual, but rather by an interaction of sacred souls, of holy ground, of honored traditions, of prayer, of friendship and laughter, with more than a little bit of work or elbow grease thrown in. And I'd like us to consider now that perhaps each of us too is a walking, talking Holden Village. You know, in another way, I and you are not simply organic machines. New physics tells us that matter is no more than a state of information. It is pure shape. It's not independent and permanent, but rather a product that has been formed in the whole flowing movement and that will ultimately dissolve back into this movement. And fractal theory tells us that the part is a reflection of the whole, and that the whole is reflected in each of the parts. And I want to touch very briefly on quantum physics, not that I fully or even partially understand it, but just a little bit of it, because I think it's so critical. We talked about reductionism, materialism and reductionism, the idea that reality is based on tiny microscopic particles, and that goes all the way back to Democritus and his postulate of the atom. And of course, atoms are real, they're there, but is there something deeper? Newton built on Democritus's premise with his belief that light itself, what we think of as pure energy, consists of tiny particles, and indeed, photons exist. He was right in a certain way. Photon within a certain sphere of understanding, he's right that we can break down light into particles. But Huygens and others said light consisted of waves. So we know now that in a way both are right. That there's wave-particle duality, as discovered by Max Planck and Albert Einstein and others. They discovered that photons, that light behaves like particles in some circumstances, but like waves in others. So what determines the manifestation? Can someone tell me what determines whether a light behaves like a photon or like a wave?
Some say the observer.
It's the observer. That's exactly right, Glenn. It's the observer. So at the level of microscopic particles, observation itself is responsible for, in a way, the condensation, my word, not the correct word, but the condensation of waves into particles. And recent studies, with some very interesting experiments by physicists in Israel, have shown that the degree of observation also varies the degree of interference patterns between waves. I don't understand it enough, but at the microscopic level, they built a kind of an electronic capacitor, which, depending on how much power they put to it, varied the degree of how much this capacitor could detect light coming through. And so the degree of observation actually changed the interference pattern in the light. And also, very interestingly, in the last 25 years, quantum physicists have shown that macroscopic particles, not just photons, but very large molecules, crystals, also have been shown to exhibit the property of wave-particle duality. Actually, now physicists are saying that everything exhibits wave-particle duality. All matter exhibits wave-particle duality. It's just that as you go from the microscopic sphere to the macroscopic sphere, it just becomes more and more difficult to measure. Now, the biomedical paradigm, the reigning medical model, while very advanced in its technological capacities, philosophically and foundationally, is at least a century behind the discoveries in quantum physics. As I said in our very first session, when you're trained as a biomedical clinician, you divide your chart note into subjective first and objective second. Subjective, what does the patient say? What do they complain about? Objective, what are their vital signs and what is the physical examination? What are the laboratory results and so forth? It's the examination is based upon a presumed distinction between subjective and objective. But in the latter, the line between, in quantum physics, the line between the subjective universe, the world of perception and experience, the world of objective reality, has not only grown thin and blurred, it has disappeared. You cannot make a completely clear distinction between what is subjective and what is objective. So, my proclamation, if I could have been here yesterday during proclamations, I would say that to understand disease, we must map out human consciousness, and that disease is a story behind the story. Disease is a constellation of symptoms which tells a story pregnant with meaning. So let me give an example. One of the most commonly understood remedies in treating chronic disease in homeopathy is a remedy called natrum muriaticum, which is just a very fancy way of saying table salt. The remedy is made from sodium chloride. Well, what is sodium chloride? Sodium chloride is, of course, a molecule which consists of two ions, sodium and chlorine, very tightly bonded with each other, right? You can't pull them apart very easily. Sodium doesn't like to exist by itself, and chlorine is very happy to have that sodium there to fill up its one valent space in its outer shell. Well, what is the story of natrum muriaticum homeopathically? Natrum muriaticum, it turns out, if we potentize it into a remedy, it resonates with the human experience of being very tightly bonded to someone else. It also resonates with tremendous grief from the breaking of a bond. It also resonates with looking into the past and thinking a lot and dwelling on the past with a sense of grief. What do we use salt as? What historically has salt been used for? But as a preservative, right? And in our story of in the Old Testament, when Lot's wife looks back at Sodom and Gomorrah and what has happened, she turns into this pillar of salt, this looking backwards. Mm-hmm. Turns out that it's actually part of the remedy picture of natrum muriaticum. People who need this remedy are vulnerable to certain physical sensitivities. For example, exposure to a lot of sun, extremely sensitive, become very dehydrated very easily. Many other physical and mental characteristics, but that somehow resonate with the morphogenetic field of salt. So, homeopathy shows it that the earth is alive and its elements, plants, and animals hold stories within them. And one of these phenomena resonates or vibrates with a frequency that will tell our own story. Each of us is holographically attuned to one of earth's elements, or a molecule, a plant, or tree, an animal, or a mushroom, or some form of energy. And that healing can occur when an observer, such as the homeopath, correctly perceives and matches the story told by the patient's symptoms and perceptions with the informational field embodied by a plant, element, or animal of our world. And somehow that very act of observation and perception crystallizes a new reality, one of healing, which proceeds along a vibrational path contained within the morphic field of the remedy. One thing I've noticed over the last 10 years of my practice is that not uncommonly, people will begin to feel better once I've consciously made the connection between the patient's state, their experience, their inner story, and the remedy, and have the intent of giving it. People sometimes will start to feel better right there and there in the consulting room. Or if it's a long-distance consultation, sometimes people will tell me that they started to feel better after the consultation, even though the remedy didn't arrive for another couple of days in the mail.
Doug, can I ask a question? Easy. Maybe you're getting to it.
Yeah.
Where does intentionality enter into this? Because we're talking about this hard to pin down, you know, what is consciousness, a lot of philosophical debate about it. But this story is kind of like, once you as the homeopath kind of bring something into focus and this intention is made, and also the person with the malady, they want to get better. They have an intention and they're open to this homeopathic interpretation. So an open question, what is intent and intentionality in this equation?
I love that question, Ben. It's something I ask myself too a lot. I don't know quite the answer, but it feels, in the experience of it, it feels to me that it is part of a causality and synchronicity. That is, the intent is there on my part to give the remedy, the intent is there on the patient's part to take the remedy, and within that field of relationship and dynamics, somehow the universe knows the remedy will be taken. So then it already starts, you know, implicate order begins to become explicate order based on that understanding.
It's like it opens a doorway.
It opens a doorway and something happens. Somehow I believe that the action of taking the remedy is a really important part of it.
Yeah.
But that somehow the time sequence becomes less important. The movement of time from point A to point B becomes less important. It's rather that the field of reality becomes this rather than that. I wish I could say this better, but I can't. It's a great question. But I believe intent is a critical part of it. But it's not the only part of it. That the remedy also, at some point or other, has to be taken. But that is part of the new reality.
Yeah.
Could the same be true then in the case of a biomedical treatment? That phenomenon,
yes,
of the patient feeling better before the treatment, the prescription or whatever?
Yes, I believe I've seen that happen. I'm just thinking, you know,
yeah,
my son Russell, if he only knew how often I refer to him, he's 20 now, but when, you know, before I was a homeopath, I remember sometimes giving him Tylenol, and I remember being astonished sometimes that as soon as the Tylenol seemed to hit his mouth, he seemed to be better. I don't really still understand that, because of course Tylenol works more in a materialist way, right, bringing fever down. But yes, I've seen that happen, so yes, I think that can happen.
Well, the placebo is used often enough, so that,
yes,
there's some active data that precedes that placebos do work.
Yes, exactly. And
it's,
you know,
the intent. If you take a placebo,
right,
it's your intent to get,
yes,
better,
exactly,
and the medicine that you're taking is nothing. And,
yes,
and the essence that you talked about this week is cut so fine, there's nothing left.
Yes.
It may be
no material left. No material. There's no material left.
Well, then what's left? If the actual plant doesn't even exist in the material anymore, because you cut it so many times and you're just left with a few molecules of what was, well, what's left? Other than you're taking this medication, but your intent is to get better.
A field of information.
Yeah, in essence.
A field of information, in essence, is left.
And that's what really stretches that Newtonian description of reality, because it,
right,
really comes down to noetics, how we know what we know.
Right.
And so, yeah, so you're,
right,
blurring of,
right,
lines.
Right. So I just want to acknowledge that this is very unbelievable. I would not believe it for a moment had I not personally witnessed it and experienced. I just want to honor all of you for listening to me this week. Thank you.
if you gave yes. your essence, your medication,
yes.
to an animal.
Yes, there's a whole branch of animal.
We've got it over the animals. We yes. think we have it over the animals.
Animals.
We have a soul,
respond.
We have a spirit. And we don't know if animals have souls or spirits or not.
But they respond to remedies.
They do respond
yes.
to the same
respond
remedies.
Dramatically to remedies.
Okay, but they
yes.
don't have the intent. Or do they just automatically have the intent? Of course, as the dog says to himself, I want to get better.
I think animals.
Well, when Glenn was asking about it, intent, I'm not sure he would. There's an intent on the part of the homeopath to heal, and there's, on the part of the patient, at least not an active opposing of the treatment being offered. So I have seen or heard of people who are so resistant or adamant to treatment that remedies get blocked. That can happen, for sure. But infants generally, animals generally, are not putting up these energetic blockages to being healed. And it doesn't require that kind of intent to for a remedy to work. Let me speak a little bit about placebo, because I think this is maybe the crux of your question. You know, isn't this placebo? And you know, sometimes we have words which gives us the feeling of understanding something that we really don't really understand. We don't really know what placebo, how to account for placebo effects. We talk about the power of suggestion, but we don't really fully understand how amazingly powerful placebos can be. You know, in Latin, placebo simply means to please the patient. And it seems to me that as a healer, our goal should be, at least in part, to please the patient. So I don't, for me personally, placebo is not a bad word. No. On the other hand, I also know from experience that the power of remedies goes way beyond the power of suggestion. Because I have patients who I have given hours of my time and loving attention who don't get better time after time after time until something clicks in my own mind in terms of an understanding of why they might need a particular remedy that I had not yet given. And then when I give that remedy, then the transformation happens. Right? So because of my daily experience, I know that this is not simply power of suggestion. I don't know if this speaks to your question, but I sense that that's at the root of your question.
Yeah. And also, animals don't have an egoic consciousness, which determines I am this, I am not that.
Yes.
Right. They just are.
Right.
And an organism would have a desire to heal, wouldn't it? Basically. I mean, rather than to destruct, to heal.
One would hope that organisms have the desire to heal.
I mean, an animal would.
Natural
stuff.
Yeah.
Like people are.
Yeah. I haven't really seen homeopathic obstacles to cure in animals. It's more homeopathically the difficulty, at least for me in treating animals, and there are other homeopaths who are much better at it than I am, is since animals can't speak.
Yeah,
it's telling, getting that inner story. You have to rely so much more on observation and someone who really is familiar with animal behavior to see what is particular and what is unusual in that particular animal patient. Yeah. So, Holder Village is an organism. Each of us is also an organized field of information with organic elements, essential organic elements, embodying form and function that transcend any particular cell or tissue. And then there exists a world organism of potential archetypal order and information which molds the shape and functioning of visible bodies through a symbiotic interplay at all levels of existence, including our emotions, mind, and consciousness. And then the right remedy, in a way, is a link. It grounds our own field of consciousness in a similar but more inclusive and expansive pattern of consciousness or archetype, so that one's own cells are provided with a roadmap to healing. In a way, what a remedy does, it grounds us in the knowledge of who we are, And what I see happening in many, not all, but many patients who get a very deep acting remedy is that their life moves from becoming a walking, living question and suffering to a walking, living answer to that question.
Doug?
Yes?
Doug, I may have missed this. Define information.
Oh, that's a
like
great...
Like an organized field of information.
Yes, that's a great question. So I like to break down the word information into the first part, information, right? So information is that which forms, that which guides. How does a developing embryo, we know that we all start as a zygote from two cells, right? An ovum and a sperm, two cells. And yes, there's DNA in there, but every cell has the same DNA, right? So how does one cell know to develop into a molar tooth? And another cell know how to develop into a spleen? Each cell has the same DNA, right? We all start with this, every cell comes with the same package of chromosomes. So there is something that transcend that material DNA to guide one part of the organism into developing a set of teeth and another into a digestive system. Right? So that's Sheldrake's point, that there must be some informational field that's non-local that guides the entelechy or the development of an organism and a species. Good. I'd love to hear more from you about what this means for who we are, if it gives you any thoughts or questions.
Question comes to mind of what do people approach you with, what type of maladies? I think of physical, psychological, emotional, that's kind of two general categories. So other than physical, like say somebody's feeling depressed, or what does homeopathy do with something kind of intangible like depression or anxiety or things that are more psychological?
Those are actually the most common reasons people see me.
Okay.
Depression, anxiety, often with that there's fatigue or a diagnosis of pain or fibromyalgia.
So where do you go from there? Or what do you offer them homeopathically?
Well, it turns out that the words depression or anxiety really mean very little, and that behind them there is a unique story. And that's also true of fatigue or low energy or adrenal fatigue or irritable bowel syndrome. I'll just give you a list of the things that people come to me for: migraines, allergies, obsessive compulsive disorder, autistic spectrum, hypersensitivity, all kinds of attention deficit disorder. These are labels which are accurate to a certain degree, just like Newton's description of light as a particle is accurate to a certain degree. But we talked in the first session about the ratio within each of us of being to becoming. And these labels have more to do with the being aspect of us. They're patterns that have become fixed, but that these are patterns that are just the tip of the iceberg, and underneath that tip of the iceberg, underneath that diagnostic label or category, is this whole hidden story. So very often when people come to see me, they start out with going through their diagnoses and what tests they've had and what doctors have said and which doctors have made the most sense to them and why they have this particular disease and that particular label and not some other label. And sometimes they're unhappy with the label, sometimes they're very happy with the label, and they say it explains a lot. But that's just the beginning of my intake. To me, that's just the starting point, because I'm not really interested in the labels at all. I'm really interested in what their perception of their whole life story has been, how they have experienced their life. Have they, for example, experienced it as a predator-prey sort of story of competition. Me against him, me against her, who's the best, who's prettier, who's smarter, jealousy, competition, fight for survival. That's going to lead me towards an animal remedy. Or maybe on the other hand, they're going to experience life as a very sensitive soul who have trouble adapting to changes in conditions, right? And they experience that oversensitivity in a particular way inside of themselves. Maybe they'll experience it as a kind of spasm and cramp. Maybe they'll experience it as a struggle with wanting stimulation but then being aggravated by the stimulation. These kinds of experiences will lead me to a remedy from the world of plants, which have to do with adapting to an environment. On the other hand, maybe at the bottom of all of their symptoms is some kind of feeling of incompleteness, some feeling of not being whole or not being capable in some way, not being able to perform in some aspect of their lives. If that's the case, they'll probably need a remedy from the world of minerals, the world of elements, which have to do with structure. Being complete or incomplete, being able to perform a certain task or not perform a certain task. So behind every, way beyond every label, very beyond every symptom, is a whole story, and that needs to be fleshed out in the homeopathic decade.
So it's emotional, spiritual, or psychological?
Right.
That really helps you determine?
It really helps me determine. Okay. And usually, not always, but usually there's also physical symptoms. And I'm looking very carefully where the language describing the emotional and the mental experience also matches what's going on in the physical body. We call that a confluence point, where the body and mind come together, right? So for example, in the case of Chameleon, right, it was his ITP caused his skin, caused spots on his skin, right? And later on, when he talked about himself as a chameleon, he talked about changing colors, right? So I could see that this is exactly where mind-body comes together in creating the energy field of his disease, right? So looking for confluence between mind and body will really help a lot in pointing towards a remedy. Now, sometimes people come in with only mental illness, and I'm actually very interested in treating mental illness, and sometimes people with just mental illness may have no physical symptoms. So it's also possible to get to a remedy that way. And sometimes people will come in with only physical problems. But most of the time we are a blend of mental and physical symptoms.
Because you don't know if depression causes a physical issue or the physical illness causes a depression.
You know, I don't actually use those words because it's not causal in that way. I used to as a nurse practitioner. You know, is this caused by something on the physical level, or is it just a mental or a psychological problem, psychosomatic? Now I realize all disease is psychosomatic. All disease exists at the level of soul and our level of vital force. And the vital force is just choosing how much of its state, how much of its disease to express physically versus to express emotionally and mentally. Now, in our society where we treat a lot of our physical symptoms with powerful drugs, antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, antihistamines, all these kinds of things, antipsychotics, antidepressants, anti-anxiety, you know, the vital force is often left with nothing but the deeper mental and emotional states to express its state. So that's why in our society, most disease is really emotional and mental. Whereas in places like Haiti or the Dominican Republic, other places where I've been, most disease is expressed at the physical level. Yes?
Question. When you talk about the synergy that comes together with to produce a disease, then you have another whole group of people that talk about sound and vibration and light. I don't understand it. It's, you know, crystals.
You mean as treatment modalities?
Yes.
Yeah, you know.
I've never taken any of that seriously, but I know people who do.
Yeah.
And how does that apply in the same type of a way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can't really speak to that. I'm no expert on those modalities. But a great question.
It's something I heard when I was taking art therapy, and I know that music can do it.
Sure.
It just depends upon what the person needs.
Yeah.
What about alcoholism, drug addiction?
Homeopathy can help a lot. There's even one particular remedy. It's called Nux Vomica. It has a very unattractive name, Nux Vomica, but it's V-O-M-I-C-A, which is particularly useful in this disorder. Again, treatment has to be individualized in every case, but in Nux Vomica, it's from a plant, there's a particular desire for stimulation and for drugs and alcohol. And I've heard stories of spouses putting a few pellets of Nux Vomica in a drink of tequila or whatever, and patient just stopping drinking. Those are apocryphal, they don't work in a lot of cases because people need individual remedies. Sometimes Sue was talking about the motivation to heal. Sometimes that motivation to heal isn't there, for whatever reason. But if someone is really motivated to heal and can give their inner story, then with the right remedy can be a huge, huge help in curing alcoholism and drug addiction.
So they have to want it, and the intent has to be there.
The intent has to be there. They have to take the remedy.
I'm still trying to find images to understand this. First of all, how the medications are made, and the principle of like, you know. Immunization is built on that. The poison that your flu or whatever. So you put a little bit into your body, and so you become resistant.
Right.
And that is building up the immune system bodily. And I think we also do that in terms of our emotional life. We become emotionally resistant, not in a way that we are repressing or suppressing, but that we are able to deal with it.
Right.
And so I feel like when you're taking homeopathic remedies, in a way, through all our lives, we take these essence of all the negativities that's there, anger, hate, so it's in our bodies, in minute, there's an essence. Mm-hmm. So if we encounter that, we can resist it. So that came to me that in a way, unless you...
I like that.
Unless you really embrace everything there is, also the negativities, particularly those, and let them be in your body and embrace them and be there as an essence, not as something that explodes into a symptom. That enables you to resist all kinds of stuff.
I really like that, I think.
Yeah, I spend a sleepless night, you know.
It's the same idea as accepting your shadow.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same idea of integrating the shadow. It's the same idea as going into the darkness spiritually, and embracing it in order to come out the other side. This is really just, I see the correct homeopathic remedy as a kind of spiritual catapult. You know, it's a spiritual technology. It allows you to do that with so much less struggle, because it mirrors back to you exactly your own propensities. It mirrors back to you the exact ways in which you get out of balance, so that you have it mirrors back a clear picture of who you have been. So it can take years off the process, I think. But yeah, I think you're exactly right.
Yeah. So yeah, how does this all relate to pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional, right?
Exactly.
And that's the pain is there.
Yes.
And you cannot ignore it or cannot stay away from it. You have to embrace it. But yeah, you don't have to let it be suffering.
Right. And dis-ease is being stuck in suffering. And we are suffering because there is something that hasn't been integrated into our being. We were meant to be a certain way. We were meant to go along a certain path, but we don't see it. We don't see where we're supposed to come, have gone. But God has meant something better for us than who we are. And so we start, instead of moving in the path, we start expressing symptoms and signs of dis-ease. And the remedy helps us see the path we were meant to.
Yes. Yeah, if you're getting advanced enough, we don't need the remedies anymore.
Yeah, you're not, you, after, you,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you, I mean, oh, this is this old thing about yoga also. Yoga, you know, the ultimate goal is, you know, lose yourself or unity and all that stuff. And so people, the sages, the people that do yoga as a means to achieve this stage. And once you are advanced enough, you do not need yoga anymore. You don't do this exercise anymore, this contortions, you know. It's the yoga is in your mind, you know. And I think that same thing is with music. Real good musicians, they don't have to make music anymore. The very end, or you can see that this that's all stupid, but there's many musicians go deaf, but they're still musicians, they still hear everything.
Like Beethoven. Yeah. I know I haven't reached a stage where I no longer need to make music, I still need to make music.
I'm not really sure how to ask the question, but what are the limits of the homeopathic remedies? I mean, everyone dies.
Right.
And so,
It's a great question. Remedies can help people die more, without suffering as much, with less anxiety, with less pain. And
so, at a certain point, the treatment would be.
One has reached the end of life, and treatment. The goal of treatment becomes easing the person into what comes next. Absolutely.
Okay.
Cancer has been. Challenge for homeopathy.
Okay.
I have helped a friend heal from a glioblastoma with a bad prognosis, kind of brain tumor, and I've helped some other cancer patients get well, but I've also lost some cancer patients. So there's been some really interesting work in India using other models of homeopathic care, rather than what I've been describing is classical homeopathy, where you get exactly the right remedy to match the whole of the person, and there's some homeopathic doctors in India who are using much more organ-specific remedies, with repeated rapidly and having some amazing results with cancer. I'm trying to learn some from them. As I've shared, I have a particularly strong interest in treating serious mental illness. Sometimes that's actually not so difficult because, say, someone with schizophrenia, sometimes will actually have less, it'll be easier to get right into the depth of their delusion, right, than someone who's extremely well compensated and hidden and covered up. But sometimes also it can be difficult to find exactly what is the center of the problem. But I believe that most cases of mental illness can be cured with me. Again, sometimes in very young children, I have difficulty because of children are nonverbal, and I'm not able to perceive in the behavior of the child exactly what the right remedy is, what the state is. And then it becomes easier when they become older. And sometimes, if an illness has gone on so long and there has been so much pathology and tissues and it's an end stage, where cancer comes to mind, or heart disease where, you know, there's say four vessel, 99% occlusion of the vessels, and the patient is say 84 years old and has diabetes and, sometimes cure is not possible. In general, the younger the patient is, and the stronger the vital force, the more they're able to respond to remedies, the higher the chance of cure. So I don't know if that helps.
I wondered about injury caused by stroke.
Oh, yes, great question.
I will tell you that, that I spent a lot of years researching alternative therapies for a stroke patient, and I never once ran into a suggestion of trying homeopathy while we tried many, many alternative
therapies. Oh, I would strongly, one of my favorite cases actually is a stroke patient.
Really?
Who I actually saw in the hospital. And a single remedy gave her her speech back.
Wow.
And I know of other homeopaths who have successfully treated stroke. So again, you know, if it's a case of 20 years of a neurologic deficit associated with continued decline, then the chances of a full recovery are much, much less than if treatment is initiated right away. Mm-hmm. But yes, yeah, strokes can be treated very effectively.
So can you tell the strength of someone's vital force by looking at them?
No, but you know, but after a while of being with them, you get a sense of it, yes.
I have a friend, Emma, I have a friend who speaks of the chakra. You'd never use that word, but you're talking about vital force and energy all the time there. She would use the word chakra. And I don't know if she can do this or not, but she'll put her hands on me and she'll swear that she can feel my energy force. And I'll swear, even though I'm a skeptic, that I can feel her energy force when she puts her hands on me.
Right.
And I don't know what to make out of that.
Yeah, well, you know, chakra, as you know, is an idea that comes from the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, right, in the Hindu mystical metaphysics. And their word for vital force is prana. And so within that metaphysical and anatomical system, we are in a grid of energy with certain chakras. And another way of viewing the vital force is the Chinese system of meridians. Again, both of these things, I think, are very valid ways of thinking of the human energy system. Homeopathy comes from Germany, comes from Europe. And we don't have that kind of energy anatomy construct, and nor is the system of homeopathy dependent upon it. But it's I think a valid alternative to understanding how energy moves through the body.
Isn't that who God is? Energy,
sorry?
Spirit, energy. That's what I've always envisioned God as being. And then we plug into a power source. God, and then we get the energy.
I don't know if any of you are like me. I sometimes have trouble. Oh, I'm way over time. Sometimes actually even saying the word God.
Because it's such a.
Because the word seems so limited.
That's what I think too. Very much. Very much. I do understand why people say the universe, because it's stupid.